did you have any follow-up from our episode 11 on Grandview, or I'm sorry, yeah, Grandview, Missouri?
Well, you know, I this is not important, but I'll just tell you that I forgot to say that we had a pond behind our house, about three houses behind our house. I'm sure that that property where our house was, and I may have said this last time, was probably a large farm at one time, because all that property around there was farms. And when Richard Scobauer Air Force Base, when they found out that was coming there, they probably did a lot of those housing developments. But anyway, we had a big pond behind the house that the very few days of the years we lived there, when it got cold enough for the pond to be frozen over, we would put on our old Norwegian ice skates and go down there and ice skate. And we would put on our cross-country skis probably the 2 days a year that there was almost enough snow to do that. We actually cross-country skied to school one day. We really did miss Norway and all the winter activities. So,
well, and you had, out of band from the podcast, we had discussed the infamous or famous picture of Granddad standing outside of your house in Missouri at his Weber grill with his wool pants and his Norwegian sweater on, yep, looking like, I'm not sure what to say, but looking very smarmy in his getup. And it led me to observe that it must have been interesting in the military with people, you know, being stationed all over the world. Whenever you got stationed somewhere, you kind of took a little bit of that culture with you. And I imagine,
absolutely,
you saw. And so I have a vision in my head, which I know never happened, but since Dad and Harry and Gracie had just gotten back from Japan, I envision you all having a picnic and the Westbrooks showing up in their Norwegian gear and the Brights showing up in their Japanese garb and trading stories about your international trips. But I'll have to save that for the movie.
And don't forget all the people that lived in Germany that came back with Lederhausen.
Of course, of course. I imagine, yes.
When I saw those the first time, I was like, holy cow, what are those things? Anyway.
And the people who got to go to Thailand instead of you probably had some pretty interesting stuff too. So
I'm sure.
All right. Well, I had a couple of minor follow-up items too. I was curious, you mentioned you and you being a member of the 4Bs, your group of girls that you ran with.
Yes.
And you mentioned that the other 3Bs were in the band. Is that correct? Or in the band?
Yes, that is correct.
That made me wonder. I know there's stories that you played the clarinet at some point. Why weren't you in the band with your clarinet?
Well, I was. And all three of the three other Bs also played the clarinet, right? So they all owned their own clarinets because they had been playing clarinet forever. And so I felt compelled to play the clarinet so I could be part of the group, right? Mm-hmm. And so Grandmom, we went down to Kansas City to a big band store where they rented instruments to school kids. And we rented the clarinet, and I got in the band. And I was in the band. You know, all of my friends were like first, second, third chair. They were actually really good, really good clarinet players. I was not. I was just learning, but I was in there, probably not quite at the tail end, but I was in there, and I got my band uniform, you know, the whole regalia, woolen band uniform in Kansas City in August, let me tell you, is hot. So, you know, we went to the football games, and this was when I was a freshman. Now, I started playing in eighth grade, but there was no band, so there was a high school band in the high school, obviously. And so I went to three or four games. Not sure we hadn't had cheerleader practices at first, but I decided to go out for cheerleading and got elected as the cheerleader in high school. And so I had to give up the clarinet and my hot wool uniform. Praise the Lord. That's all I can say. And that was the history of my clarinet playing.
Okay. I was wondering if it was, if there was before that or if that was it. So that's, I'm glad we got that out. And the other 3Bs remained in the band playing clarinet, or did they follow you into the cheerleading corps?
Yes. No. Well, I think they tried out, but I was the only one that made the the cheerleading team. So, well, the funny thing is, the second year, Mom decided, into the second year, I guess, Mom decided it would be cheaper just to go ahead and buy the clarinet, since it looked like I was going to be playing it for a while. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I got elected. So we held on to it for years. And Aunt Mary's daughter ended up with it. And she played it, I think, in the high school band at Auburn. And then when she went to college, she gave it back. And Billy ended up with it at some point.
I was going
to
say, I thought I remembered it being around in El Paso or somewhere. Yeah,
you did. You did. In that little saddle tan fake leather case. Anyway, yeah. One reason that I really despised band also was the band leader in eighth grade. And his name, I wish I could remember it, but I have erased it from my brain, because he weighed about 350 or 400 pounds. Not that that matters. He chewed on a cigar the whole time we were having band, which was not disallowed back then, you know?
Of course, yeah.
Of course. And he would look over at me or other kids in the band who were playing the reed instruments and go, hand me that clarinet. I don't think your reed is wet enough. And he would put it in his mouth and slobber all over it. And that was so revolting and disgusting to me that I could barely stand to go to band every day. That would never happen today, as you know.
I don't know. I wouldn't make any assumptions like that.
Disgusting.
Okay. So my other, and I like the fantasy picnic scenario I proposed a few minutes ago. This is, even if this did not happen the way I'm about to propose it, I'll make it this way when we make the movie. Okay. But you remember when Granddad, you mentioned, had to walk into town to bail out Sambo after his streetlight shooting out incident, because the Austin Healey was in the shop. I have to connect the dots and wonder, was the Austin Healey in the shop because Bruce had just backed over it? Or was it?
Yes,
just,
it was.
Okay. So those stories are connected.
Those stories are connected. And I do want to tell you, that when you had a foreign car back in those days, especially somewhere like Kansas City, Missouri, which was the middle of the United States, and, you know, you'd have had better luck if you were in LA or New York, let's put it that way. It took almost 7 months to get it fixed because they couldn't get the parts.
And I feel like I should know this, but Austin Healey is what, an English brand?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, that wraps up all the questions I have for now, at least in terms of the Grandview episode. And I think we're going to move on to talk about your early married years, starting after your wedding, which we discussed a couple episodes ago, which happened on August 22nd, 1964 in Fairbanks, Alaska.
No.
And I can't remember how much. I know we talked about the honeymoon a little bit and some other odds and sods last time. And if we overlap some of that, that's okay. But I'll let you pick up the narrative any point after there that you like.
Okay. Well, the wedding was actually in Anchorage, not Fairbanks.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a big difference right there. And Chapel number 3 on Elmendorf Air Force Base is where it took place. And I'm not sure if I told you this story again, but you could get rid of it if I did. So when you were getting married, the chaplain Makepeace, was a Presbyterian. You know, when you're in the Air Force, when you're in the military, you just get what you get, you know, whoever's stationed there, whether they're, unless you're Catholic or Jewish, if it's Presbyterian, Methodist, Baptist, whatever, that's the chaplain you get. So Chaplain Makepeace was Presbyterian, and he required that couples who were getting married have 5 sessions with him to talk about the difference in married life and single life and, you know, how to work together and all that kind of stuff. So my brother Ben, who was 7 or 8 years younger than me, whenever we had, of course, we didn't have any kind of modern phones back then. They had a cord, you know, that was hanging on the wall. You answered it. And so Ben was usually the one answering the phone because he was in middle school and phone calls were all important, right? So he would rush to the phone to answer it, you know, go, "Colonel Westbrook's quarters, Ben speaking." And so Chaplain Makepeace would say, "This is Chaplain Makepeace, is Fran there?" And so without covering the phone or anything, reducing the volume of his voice, Ben would yell at the top of his lungs, "Chaplain Makepeace calling from cloud nine," which was, you know, and then I would have to get on the phone and go, "Hello." I was like, "Yeah, thanks, Ben." So yeah, we went through that through our five discussions of married life and whatever. So then, the wedding was set for August 22nd, 1964, which was that summer. Since we were in Alaska, we did not have very many family members that showed up. Your dad's best man was Cully Klein, who was a friend of his that was in law school at the University of Missouri and also in the Sigma Chi fraternity, which your dad belonged to. And Cully was also in USAF ROTC. So they would fly together. So he flew up for the wedding. Sambo happened to be there for his leave from the Air Force Academy, I guess, or when he was doing his Rhodes Scholar, I can't remember which, but anyway, he was there and Bruce did not come. He was shooting off a missile at Vandenberg Air Force Base, I think, and couldn't get away. And Ben and Richard were living at home. So all of them were there and were in the wedding. My mother-in-law-to-be, Gracie, your grandmother, came up, but Harry did. She was the only one in the Bright family that made it. And then that was about it. And Bruce, the Majars were there. They were both in the wedding, Bruce and Pam. And I think that was about it. Mom and Dad, of course. And so we got married in chapel number 3 and had a big reception at the Air Force Officers Club afterwards. I think about 400 people. It was a big wedding. And we spent our wedding night in the Captain Cook Hotel down in Anchorage. So let's see what. So then after the next day, we had made a reservation, and I think we've been over this in one of the other podcasts, at the Hetty Hotel. We had planned to go to Homer Spit. They had a big spa and kind of a fancy for Alaska. I'll say that. That doesn't mean anything if you say fancy for the United States, but a fancy hotel for Alaska. And it had gotten taken out by the earthquake on March 29th, 1964, the biggest earthquake that had ever hit Alaska. And it was bad and it was devastating. So anyway, Dad had arranged for us to spend the first night in an Air Force station halfway between Anchorage and Homer Spit. So that night was lovely. We had two military cots with a wool blanket, one on each cot, like you would sleep in a camping tent or something. And we ate in the mess, which was, you know, where there were like six guys stationed down there to run this place. And, you know, we visited with them and got up early the next morning and headed on for the next half of the trip to Homer Spit. It took forever. It was not that far. You could have made Homer Spit in one day from Anchorage if the roads hadn't been totally destroyed. And all the bridges, and there are a lot of bridges in Alaska because there's a lot of water, had been taken out by the earthquake. And so the Army Corps of Engineers had made these very creepy 55-gallon drums tied together with ropes that, of course, when you drove over them, moved with the motion of the water. They worked, but they were pretty scary. Anyway, we must have had like 10 of those on the way down there. And every time you came to one, you had to slow down to almost a stop, because if you were going too fast, it made the motion of the bridge and the water, you know, felt like a roller coaster. So anyway, we got down to Homer Spit, and the place we had made a reservation to stay in since the big lodge had been wiped out by the earthquake was the Hetty Hotel. It was a family style, old fashioned Victorian house. We had a room with a bathroom about six doors down on the other end of the hall. And every time we went out, everybody in Homer Spit looked at us like we were complete strangers, which we were. Anyway, it was a weird experience, but we had fun. And then we headed back to Anchorage, I guess, after a couple of days. We both had jobs, so we went back to work. We decided to go ahead and work until we had to leave in October, and we weren't sure when we were going to have to leave. The military was going to let us know, but we thought it would be October. And so we kept working and lived with mom and dad at Elmendorf Air Force Base. And then we got orders to go to Williams Air Force Base, which excitedly was our first choice. There are a lot of military air training bases around the United States. And we thought William was the best because there's some like in Wichita Falls, I think Minot, North Dakota, Selma, Alabama. And anyway, so we got Williams Air Force Base, which is outside, it's in Chandler, Arizona, outside of Phoenix and south of Mesa, Arizona. And it was, that was farm country. Irrigating, your dad and I had never been to Arizona. So it was a whole, we'd never been to the desert.
I was going to say that was the first time you lived in the desert, right?
Yeah, it was a whole new adventure. And so that area down there was all citrus orchards that were irrigated, like El Paso, you know, canals that you turn the water on and off. It was beautiful, beautiful citrus farm country. Mesa had Arizona State University, so it was a larger town, but not real big. But Chandler was a tiny little farm town. So we got there, we stayed at Williams Air Force Base in the visiting officers' quarters, went out the next morning. Well, wait, let's go back. We left Alaska about mid-October 1964. We flew from Alaska, from Anchorage to Seattle to Salt Lake City to Wichita, Kansas, where my brother Bruce was stationed. We stayed with him for 2 days. When Bill flew to Alaska for the wedding, he had left our car, the car we had bought, a 1964 MGB, had left it with Bruce.
The car, and you had bought that when you were in college?
Dad bought it just before he left for Alaska. So that we would have something when we got down there and not have to deal with it.
Okay, and dad being my dad.
Your dad, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He asked Bruce if it'd be okay if he left it in Wichita. And Bruce said, yeah, sure, love to drive it.
What color was that 1964 MGB?
British Racing Green.
Oh, nice.
Nice. Unfortunately, with a black interior. It gets hotter in Phoenix than it does in El Paso, if that gives you any clue.
So it's probably different, but I'm envisioning that kind of plasticky leather that's kind of pebbly that used to be in the VW Bugs. No?
No, it was real leather.
It was nice leather. Yeah, okay. Was it convertible? Are all MGBs convertible, or is it?
I think they are. This one was. And of course, none of them were air conditioned. Why would you need air conditioning in England?
That's funny to think how many, the idea of owning an English car today is so absurd. and there's all these English cars popping out in this story.
I know.
That's fantastic. All right. So, okay. So dad had bought.
Let me say it was a poor choice for Phoenix, Arizona, because they, like Kansas City, had no foreign car places to work on foreign cars.
Right on. So dad had dropped that off at Bruce's before dad went to Alaska to get married, hung out with you for a couple months or whatever it was. And then you guys flew back to Bruce's, picked up your car, and headed towards Chandler, Arizona.
Correct. So I can't remember. I think that just took one day. It seems like that would be a one-day drive, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, I think you could do that. We can say that.
Yeah, and of course, we didn't have much money, so, you know, we were get from A to B as quickly as possible. So we stayed in the military visiting officers' quarters at Chandler. The next morning, we got up early. Your dad went to the officers' club, I think, and picked up a newspaper and a cup of coffee and came back. And we started looking for a place to live.
There was no on-base housing?
No. So we looked at a few things in Chandler and decided it was just too remote, too, because I needed to get a job too. There just wasn't much there. So we started looking in Mesa and we found, I don't know, we probably looked at five or six places, but we found a one bedroom apartment that was handy to the road to get to the base. I guess the Williams Air Force Base was probably about 15 miles from Mesa, I'm guessing, because we only had one car. So I had to take your dad to work if I needed the car. And it was one of those deals. You're familiar with that. Yeah,
I am.
Anyway, so we found a place. We didn't have anything except our clothes, you know, and our toiletries. So we rented this place and then we went out for the weekend and bought some furniture. I remember we went to Phoenix where they had a better selection of stuff. We bought a sofa, a couple of chairs and a bed, you know.
Put them in the back of your MGB.
Yeah, had it delivered. Yeah. We put the pillows in the back of the MGB and some towels. Yeah, we had nothing. You know?
Okay, so I can I slow down and ask a few? I just, the idea of you guys looking for your first place to rent together. I mean, I know you've known each other for a long time and stuff, but I think back to when I first moved to Austin, you know, pre-internet. So it's kind of more like what you were doing than what it would be like now in terms of like
exactly. Just
the running around and looking at neighborhoods. And you guys have never lived in the desert and you're looking in neighborhoods that you don't know what's what. And did you end up somewhere where there were a bunch of other military people or did you just, was it all shots in the dark or like, how did you?
It was shots in the dark. You know? there were a lot of other, you know, students in pilot training classes there, ones that were finishing up, ones that were moving in, ones that had been there, you know, 6 months, whatever. But there were a lot of like retired people and just, you know, regular old people.
And you and dad were, remind me, 20 or 19 and 20, or how old were you then?
I was 19 and your dad was 23, I guess, 22 or 23. So yeah, I was 19 years old. Imagine that.
I love imagining that, but at the same time, I feel like I can't imagine that.
Yeah, I'm. You know, we look back and I look back on that. I'm like, wow. You know, I was right at the cusp. I was thinking about this last night of the change from when women went to school to get an MRS, and when they went to school to actually get an education and get a higher education. You know, doctors, lawyers, and stuff like that. It was the very, I don't know anybody that was doing that then, but it was right after that period, you know.
Well, you straddled it really interestingly because you went and you got your MRS, but then you were like, I'm not just getting my MRS. I'm going to continue as well, even if it takes me 20 years to get my degree. I know it didn't take 20, but I know you went to several schools across the nation.
It took 13.
13. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I was determined. Yeah. But so think of it this way, which it'll be a lot more understandable to you. Look at the difference between Bruce and Sambo and Richard and Ben.
Yeah.
I was right in the middle of that huge changeover.
Yeah. And there was so much going on driven by, you know, mass media, post-war prosperity, and then
sex,
the wars
and rock and roll,
sex, drugs and rock and roll, the wars in Korea and Vietnam. And I mean, and so let's place this a little bit in terms of media and culture, like what was, you guys were listening to the radio on your road trip, I presume, or like what was
all the time,
all the time
radio.
And you probably didn't own a TV, but TVs, you had had a TV since Grandview. So TVs were around, or did you guys own a TV?
We didn't, but we bought one. For our apartment, a small TV, small black and white TV, of course, to watch football games, right?
Yep. And then,
yeah, I mean, we didn't, that's about the only thing we watched on TV was football games.
And then this was what, 1964? And my history is not perfect, but that's like right in the midst of, you know, JFK had just been, or MLK, JFK, yep. Bobby Kennedy, all that was going on. Is that correct?
Well, JFK was murdered in 63. So, yeah, that was the start of it.
Yeah.
And you know, social unrest and the Beatles, and it was that whole era of complete change, really.
And then when was the Korean War? Was that ongoing or did?
No, that was back in the 50s. That was, okay. That was done.
Okay. So, but
Vietnam
was heating up. Okay. And I remember when we watched that PBS Vietnam thing, how I started so much earlier than I remembered. It was starting up that early, right? As early as this 64.
It was when we were the Tonkin Gulf, when they shot boat or whatever, when it started, all that was when we were in Alaska. So I think it was probably, you know, 63, the Bay of Pigs was when we were up there, and the Russian Cold War, back to, you know, we're only 43 miles from the Russian. Yeah, all of that was going on.
And were you guys like engaged in that? Like were you and Dad seeking out that news, or was it just kind of like how was it? And I know that was back at a time where everybody received their same dose of the same news every day. So it was sort of what was that like? How much part of your life was that?
Well, we didn't even realize that at the time. So, you know, we took a newspaper every day. I think it was called the Mesa Sun. We took Time in Newsweek magazines that came once a week. We read them cover to cover. We listened to the news on the TV when we happened to be there and had time, you know, as a student, and our time was limited to do stuff like that. So, but yeah, there was a lot going on. So the Vietnam War had already started when your dad started flight school. And so everybody going through flight school was being trained to go to the war. Not that the training was any different, but that was the, you know.
They knew what they were headed for.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so yeah. So we got there, we got settled in our apartment. I think we got there like 4 or 5, 6 days, maybe before flight school started. I started looking for a job and ended up with one at the Desert Medical Proving Ground, which was on the way. It was between Mesa and Williams Air Force Base. It was out. I know, I didn't mess it up that time. I did not say Desert Medical Proving Ground. Did I?
Yeah, I think you did, actually.
No, I didn't. I said General Motors.
General Motors. Okay. Let's stop here. Let's say it correctly in case.
General Motors Desert Proving Ground. It was located halfway between Williams Air Force Base and our apartment in Mesa, Arizona. It was out in the absolute boonies, and it was a super secret place where they tested the next model cars that were coming out. Your dad and I had no idea what we were in for when we got moved to Arizona, but we had never seen or been in the desert. It was fascinating, and we fell in love with it, actually. But there were also mountains there, great mountains, the Superstition Mountains. You know, it was big. It's big mining country. Copper, Anaconda copper mines are there. Turquoise, lots of stones, you know, stuff like that. And some other metals too, which I'm not sure of, but copper was the big thing. And the Superstition Mountains were full of, you know, ghost stories about mines and people getting lost and all that kind of stuff. And they were beautiful. I mean, You lived in the desert. You know what it like. You know what it's like. It grows on you.
I'm curious. Did you, like, when we moved to El Paso? I can't remember. I was, I guess, 12 or 13, and my references for desert were basically Speedy Gonzales and Roadrunner cartoons.
Yeah, ours too.
And so I was, you know, delighted and relieved when I arrived in El Paso, and it was, as you know, it was so different, but it was also normal in the way that, you know, the world is normal. But so did you guys have cartoons like that as a mental reference, or did you have even that?
We did. And I'll tell you, every day when I took your dad to work at Williams Air Force Base, we would see Roadrunners running across the road, you know, numerous times, because it was out in the boonies, and they're as fast as the cartoons show them, you know. It looks like they're going to get run over, and they shoot right across in front of you. That, and the other weird thing was, I guess because it's farmland, it was farmland out there, I'm sure it's all developed now, but these huge, I mean huge tarantulas, you would see them crossing the road. Gross. And the roadrunners and snakes, you know, all the stuff the desert has out in the middle of nowhere. So yeah, that was wild and different. And your dad had an opposing schedule every week. So they flew one week and had to be at work at 4 o'clock in the morning, because the thermals are so bad in Arizona, like they were in El Paso, that it makes it super bumpy and hard to take off. There's something about the heat and the thermals that's, you know, it opposes getting an airplane off the runway. And so I would take him out at the crack of dawn 1 week, and then the next week they would have like an 8 to 5 schedule, and they'd have class all week. So that was kind of interesting, but we did manage to make it work with my job and his training. And I cannot tell you how many people we had in our class. I'm guessing 25, maybe 30. Some of them washed out is the term for not making it. You know, there were pink slip times all through the course. Like, you got 3 times to learn how to land. You got 3 times, and you know, if you couldn't do it, you got a pink slip. And if you couldn't do it the next time, you washed out. So the attrition rate was not horrible, but we did lose some folks. And one thing that made our...
Did Dad ever get a pink slip?
Yeah, he did. For throwing up, I told you. He had motion sickness.
Oh, that's right. And then he went out and rode all the rides to prevent, or to teach himself not to have motion sickness.
Yes.
Was that in Phoenix that he did that, or in Mesa?
Well, no, we went to Phoenix. They had an amusement park down there. And his instructor said to him, "Bright, if you don't learn how not to throw up when you're flying, you're going to wash out. Take your wife and go down to the amusement park and ride roller coasters and those spinning coffee cup things, you know, until you don't throw up." And so we went down and did that. And yeah, he got over it. So.
And did you ride along, or did you watch him ride?
Of course, I rode. You know, I've never gotten motion sick, so it was a long day, I'll tell you that. Anyway, yeah, with a lot of throwing up to start with. Anyway, so yeah, we did that. And what I was going to tell you, what made our class really interesting is that we had 13 German Air Force students going through with us. They had an agreement with a lot of the foreign countries that were allies of the United States. Uh-huh. that bought airplanes from the United States to train them in United States pilot training classes. So
you said there was about 25, and there was some rate of attrition washing out. So did they, in addition to going to school together, was it like, did they become a group and, you know, barbecue and party together?
Oh, yeah, we did. Okay. Oh, absolutely. Huh. So, yeah, I was going to tell you that it was like school and flying all week, and then party all weekend. until Sunday afternoon. It was study time, right? Super study time. Yeah, we had a blast with them. Well, the Germans like to party to start with, as do the Norwegians. And if you know what the weather is like in Germany, it's about as miserable as anywhere in the world. The sun doesn't shine much.
I've experienced some of that, yes.
Yeah, it's freezing cold. It's just miserable. And so some of the German students were married. Most of them weren't, but we had a couple in the apartments where we lived. And so when everybody graduated and they were getting their orders to where they were going to go, of course, all the German students were going back to Germany. The German wives did not want to leave.
Of course. Yeah.
They spent all of their days out by the swimming pool. They said, there is no way we can soak up enough sunshine to last the rest of our lives unless we stay.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. And very, very few of us, maybe two, had kids. So, you know, we were all party hogs.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a very stressful. Pilot training was stressful. You know, they were all learning new stuff. It was difficult.
And what was the, I know you mentioned the throwing up and the physical aspect and the, I would imagine, agility of being a pilot. Was there like math and physics involved too? Or was that,
stuff? There was a ton of math. And then, you know, you had to learn all the weather and how, you know, the weather systems.
Oh, yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. And then you had to learn how to pilot a plane, basically navigation and everything, if your instruments went out. So, yeah, it's very math oriented.
And how long is pilot training?
It's a little over a year. The first half is learning how to fly in a T-37, which is what it was then, which is not a jet. And then the second half is learning how to fly a jet, which, you know, basic flying is basic flying, but flying a propeller driven plane and flying a jet are two totally different things. So I'm trying to remember the number of the jet that they flew. It's what NASA still flies for their pilots. T-33 was the first one, trainer 33, right? I mean, T-37, I'm sorry. And the next one was 33, I think. I'll have to look that up. It's a great looking little, it looks like a fast mosquito. It looks like a super jet, you know?
Uh-huh,
I mean,
uh-huh.
And they've been using them obviously for 50 years. They're great trainer planes. And of course they had two seats. You had to have a instructor with you.
Okay.
Well, and you know, they had that you go through, you learn all of the basics first, how to talk on the radio, how to communicate, which is totally different because it's one-way communication, how to all the safety stuff, and then the mathematics of navigation, and then you do your cross country by yourself, and you got to, you know, do a flight plan, all again mathematical, and figure out where you're going to go and how you're going to get back and not get lost, right?
Okay, so tell me more.
Got lost.
Tell me more about that. So Dad takes off from Williams Air Force Base in a jet and has to go, or what? Tell me.
Well, first they did it in the T-37s, and they had that. You know, they do a flight plan. They have to be gone, you know, an hour, 2 hours, whatever. The stipulations are, they have to map it out on a map, how many miles, how many, you know, the direction, north, northeast, whatever, all that. And then a turn and a pivot point, and then to the place where you're going to turn around and come back. And sometimes if on the longer ones, they had to stop and refuel and then get back in the plane, it's complex. It's a, you know.
Yeah, no, well, that's, and it's, I mean, it sounds a little bit trite to keep saying it, but like it pre-internet, you know, these were paper maps and
yeah, absolutely.
No, like, completely manual cockpit, I imagine.
Yep.
And
so it
would just be one plane at a time, not a group of planes doing that.
One plane at a time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the idea was to take off, not get lost, and get back, right?
Uh-huh. And so do you remember like where Dad flew at his long one? Like when he, if he had to, when he had to fly somewhere and land and come back?
I think he flew to Waco, not Waco, but shoot, what's that one out in the middle of nowhere in Arizona? It's west of Tucson. There was one of them. And I just remember, you know, when he was doing it and when he would get home, he would just be like completely drained, you know, stressful. And then, of course, when you're out there and you've never been up in the sky, you got to constantly be looking for other planes, too, because they didn't have what they call, you know, the computers or the glass is what they call it now. All planes still have all those manual things. But in case the glass goes out, you still got to be able to navigate it, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I remember Bill Biggs and Bill Dickinson wanted to fly to the islands, and they wanted me to go with them. And I said, no way, I'm going over that much water in a single engine plane. You guys go for it. And so they had everything ready. They thought they had everything. They left Miami and got out over international waters and realized that they didn't have the glass maps. You have to buy maps for each section of the country. They had paper maps, but not glass maps. And so they both said, we both had to quickly relearn how to do how to plot a trip manually, right? Instead of just putting it in. And yeah, they said actually it was probably good for us, but you know, they went all the way around the Caribbean. And I think about halfway through, they hooked up with that company that makes military maps, and you can buy them and they automatically download it to your computer in your airplane. So that's what they did. But yeah, they said that was quite the shocker. So, but, and I know that Bill practices regularly going, you know, at least one leg of the trip, doing it manually, just so you don't lose the skill. Yeah. So T-33 is the second trainer. Pull it up and see what it looks like. It's quite the slick looking little plane. And like I said, NASA still uses them for their astronauts to get their flying time. I know you saw them when we lived in El Paso. They were always landing and taking off there.
Oh yeah, that's an interesting looking plane.
And of course they, you know, they go Mach 1 and all that stuff that you got to learn how to deal with when you're flying a jet. So speed in terms of miles per hour and speed in terms of being on top of your instruments.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't imagine what it must be like to fly a jet, like that whole having to be like, you know, so far ahead in your head of where you are, like that's got to be crazy.
Exactly. Yeah. So, well, a lot of that, you know, you do a flight plan and plug in ahead of time. So you've got the basics there and you just got to be sure nothing's going wrong, right?
Yeah. And so I guess this gets a little bit off in the weeds pretty quickly, but like as a pilot without a navigator in a plane like that, back before computers, like are the instruments telling you where you are geographically, or are you looking at landmarks, or how are you navigating like that?
Before, well, you know, they had to learn to navigate without computers first. And so it's landmarks. You know, you look for highway intersections, cities, rivers, mountains, that kind of thing.
Okay. That's what I would have, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then of course you got to do, they have like a, it looks kind of like a, did you ever, you know what a slide rule is? Have you ever seen a slide rule?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. For mathematics.
I think you forget about all the cereal box tops I saved up to send away for a slide rule when we lived in Burke. It was my first experience sending away for something on the back of a cereal box. And I remember it took them about 3 months to send it to me. And I was expecting it every day for like, for that 3 months. You don't remember that?
Yeah. Well, I do now, but the instrument, and I can't remember what it's called, but it's round and it looks like a slide rule. It's got, you know, thousands of numbers on it. And that's what you use to figure out where you're going and how how long it's going to take so that you get from one waypoint to the next at the right time.
Wow.
Anyway, yeah, it was a lot of studying, and it's hard, you know, it's not a walk in the park. Let's put it.
It's quite the mix of skills, you know. It's like the intellectual pursuit of a university degree combined with kind of the physical, or not physical, that's not the right word, but the motor skills or whatever of of other kinds of work.
I will tell you that your dad was mathematics and physics were probably his lowest skills, but he was so he had such great as I don't even know how to say this, but as a sportsman, you know, a runner and he had such great skill in feel, you know, like flying the airplane with the stick. He would have been great in games, you know, these digital games and everything.
So something I've, and I'm interested to hear what you have to say about this, because something I've heard people talk about, like in the, you know, outside of our family in more recent years in my life, I've been exposed to people talking about Air Force pilots and kind of the mentality of the Air Force pilot or the mentality of the soldier in general, and how in addition to there being a size issue, and can't be too tall, you have to have good eyesight. But there's also kind of and it's not a lack of intellectualism, but it's a personality is what I'm trying to get at. There's a personality type for a fighter pilot where you can't be too introspective. Does that bear out to you?
Your dad, one of your dad's favorite sayings was indecision will kill you. And he always said, just make a decision, any decision, when you're up there flying and you've got an emergency. If it doesn't work, do it, make another decision.
Do something else. Yeah,
because if you sit there and do nothing, you're going to die. So,
yeah.
And I will say that, I think the fact that, back to this sports thing, that he was a quarterback and he was so good at throwing the ball and so good at catching the ball and so good at judging the space. I think that's, I know many of his friends who told me that Bill was just an exceptional fighter pilot. So, and I think part of it was that he could make a decision, you know, when in trouble. I don't know what, you hear that some people are just natural athletes. I don't know if that's true or not, but then you look at, he had experiences in his lifetime that he lettered in all the sports. He lived in a foreign country. He became an Eagle Scout. Probably all of that stuff goes into your personality, right?
Yeah.
I mean, from being in scouts that, when they put you out in the desert for 3 days and you had to survive on your own skills, that's a lesson, you know?
Yeah. And I'm just curious, the decisiveness, that makes a lot of sense. Which is to say the opposite of the kind of introspective, not to say that introspective is bad. It definitely has its place. And I mean, like, I feel like I'm, if anything, I err on the introspective side, although I can also make a decision, I feel like, but in terms of like, cause I, you know, fighter pilots have this kind of stereotype of being type A and, you know, kind of up and aggro or whatever, but then there's also kind of the happy-go-lucky or carefree aspect to not being introspective. I don't think I would classify dad as happy-go-lucky, but would you between type A and happy-go-lucky?
I would put him on the introspective side. And your dad was extremely smart, a deep thinker, you know.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, his big interests were Russian history, the Cold War, all of that kind of stuff. That's kind of heavy, you know. But he loved to party too, you know, when it came to having a good time. but on an everyday, he was a thinker.
Okay. That's good. When was graduation from flight school?
It was in February of 1966.
And at what point did they know where they were going next?
About a month before they graduated. And I think, well, of course, we had the 13 German students, so they were going back to Germany. I think probably all but one or two of the American pilots volunteered to go to Vietnam. Your dad was one of those. There were some, and they volunteered in different planes. You had your choice. That didn't guarantee you were going to get it, but you had to be like, you had to have that personality to be chosen to be a fighter pilot. And I guess the instructors figured that out, right?
Hold on. And so I you're saying that some people that graduated from flight school did not become fighter pilots. They just became plain old pilots.
They became, I hate to say this because it's rude, but your dad and the other fighter pilots called them trash haulers.
Yeah. Okay.
Because that's, I've heard that. They flew those big airplanes that, you know, delivered supplies and delivered men and, you know, all that kind of thing. But they don't require the instant decision making that a fighter pilot does, because as your dad said, they go low and slow.
Okay, I would have guessed that those guys would have gone to an altogether different flight school. I'm surprised. So they'd make that determination during the course of flight school. It's like, okay,
yeah,
these are the fighter pilots and these are the trash haulers, as you said.
Well, and they have to, or the B-52 pilots, which are the bombers.
Bombers, you know? Yeah. Uh-huh, yeah.
And who also go in, they go in low and slow, but the fighter pilots protect them.
Yeah. Okay. So, and so dad volunteered for Vietnam and was classified as a fighter pilot and graduated.
He was assigned to go to F4 school.
Okay. And so that was another school. And so had he not flown an F4 when he was in flight school at all?
No. The only two planes you fly are the T-33 and the T-37.
Okay.
And it takes that amount of time to learn the systems, you know, of a basic prop flight in a basic jet, the most basic of both, I'm sure.
And then, so what happened? So from, I'm guessing, in February of 1966, graduated from flight school at Williams Air Force Base, and then I imagine went directly to F4 school?
He did, but it was a series of different trainings. And I'll tell you, I stayed in our apartment in Mesa because he went to Tucson, Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, for a three-month basic F4 school, you know, learning how to fly the airplane and all of its various instruments. And the F4 had a navigator, so he had to learn how to work with a navigator. Mm-hmm. And this was a big issue with your dad, and to trust the navigator. He would rather have been doing it himself.
Uh-huh.
I will say that many times over. Okay.
That's yes. I spoke to at least one of his navigators at that reunion we went to, and the navigator, I can't remember the entirety of the story, but at some point along the way, I exclaimed, saying, "Oh, I didn't realize the navigator could override the pilot." And this guy, that made this guy laugh and laugh and laugh and say, "I would never have been in a flight or in an airplane with your dad if I couldn't override his decisions."
That's funny. Your dad had a tendency to do what he thought was right, not necessarily what he was commanded to do, right? He never got over that they couldn't bomb all those North Vietnamese trucks and tanks and everything going south on the Ho Chi Minh Highway that they saw back coming back to their base on the way from bombing up in North Vietnam. Every bombing mission, everything that they bombed had to be approved by President Johnson, who didn't have a clue what was going on over there. So anyway, what do they call those targets of, targets of opportunity. So they were not allowed to bomb targets of opportunity, only what they had been told they could do. So anyway, yeah, so he went to Tucson for 3 months and came back, and we packed up and sent our belongings to storage. And then he had to go to a school in MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, where they did bombing training for 3 months. And that was another interesting, you know, this was all new to both of us. So interesting. We got another apartment down there.
Okay, so you so when you went to Tampa, you followed along and left the, you moved
that
way.
And I wasn't really supposed to. Yeah.
Okay, but so did you move out of your apartment in Phoenix, or did you keep the apartment in Phoenix?
No, we moved out.
Okay, and so you guys together left to Tampa. Do you know when that was?
It was in June. It was in July.
Of 1967? Or of 1966. February of 1966 was graduation from Williams Air Force Base, and then a couple of months in Tucson, and then in July you're heading to Tampa.
Yep.
Okay.
First part of July.
Uh huh.
So we got to Tampa, and it was supposed to be a temporary duty assignment, which meant he could have stayed on the base in bachelor's quarters. But he was like, I'm not leaving you behind. I'm going to war. So we'll just rent something. So we drove down there in the MGB in July. Nice. Hot, nice and hot.
From Phoenix to Tampa.
Found a one bedroom. Exactly. Found a one bedroom apartment down there. And you know what? We did not have the MGB. We had sold it. When you worked at General Motors Desert Proving Ground, you could buy, they had the cars that they tested, they would sell to the employees. So most of them, some of the ones, if they had been doing those mountain roads as fast as they could or whatever, you did not want, because they were, you know, they put hundreds of thousands of miles on them testing them. And then there were some that they just set out in the sun to see how the upholstery did and stuff. And then they had some that they just rode around they had a big track, you know, like a racetrack, like a NASCAR track, out there in the middle of the desert, where they just drove them around to see how long the tires lasted. Anyway, that was one I think it was the Pontiac engineer said to me, this is a really great car, this Oldsmobile 442, Fran, if you want one, you should buy it. So I did. It was a red 19, it was for the next year, so it would have been a 1967 Oldsmobile 442. It had air conditioning.
Okay, nice. And that replaced your MGB.
Yes. So we got that.
That's a rocking looking car. That's a muscle car. That's a car.
It was a rocking car. Let me tell you, that thing would go about 140 miles an hour. We got it going out on one of those desert roads. And it had four on the floor, you know, shift, mm-hmm. and a double barrel exhaust. It was a rocking car. That engineer was right. That was a hot car. He said, you're going to love this car. And he was right. So anyway, we took that car. We went to Tampa. We found an apartment, and your dad started to bombing school and whatever else they learned. It was night bombing. So we would get up like 2 o'clock in the morning, and he'd get dressed. I'd fix him breakfast, and he'd go out, and they'd go out over the Gulf, I'm sure, you know, and bomb targets out there, and then come home. And then it was kind of like pilot training. The other week they would have class, you know, it was a lot of, again, a lot of mathematics and stuff, because, you got to learn how to drop those bombs. It's not just not just pushing a lever, right?
Some trajectories involved.
Trajectories and all that stuff, where they're going to go, where they're going to land, how much damage they're going to do. Anyway, so we were there until September, the end of September. And we decided that I would go back to Mesa. That seemed like I was familiar with it after a year, and I liked it in the desert. There were no earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes. It was, you know, It's and they had a couple of colleges where I could get some courses, and so went out there, found me an apartment, a one bedroom apartment, and the girl next door to me, the woman next door to me, had two tiny children, like a baby and a 2 year old, and her husband had just been sent. He had just left for Vietnam, so that was nice to have a neighbor. The guys on the second floor above me were going through pilot training, and so you know it was a young. I felt like I had support there, right? And I thought it was close. And I thought it was close enough to El Paso to, you know, be close to mom and dad and the boys. So got that. Got out the newspaper again. Well, after Bill left, I think he left on the 12th of October, 1966. He flew to San Francisco, I think, and left from there with a small bag of clothes, and that's it. So then I got settled in, picked up a newspaper, went out for some job interviews, ended up getting a job at Salt Water. It was the electric company, the Salt Water Electric Company or something like that. It did all the power for Arizona. I don't think of the name of it, but that's not right, but it's something like that anyway. And it was basically working for the guy who was head of finance. And so I ended up sitting there at a typewriter all day, typing numbers into Excel sheets. Boring, boring, boring.
Salt River Project.
Salt River. Yeah, that's it. So I worked all day from 8 to 5, and then I signed up for courses at Phoenix, University of Phoenix, or that might have been it. But anyway, for 2 courses, and I went to school from 6 to 10 every night, or 3 nights a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It was brutal, but it kept me busy. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the only way to get news then was to turn on the TV, listen to the news, or I got a newspaper every day. And the headlines every morning in the Mesa Sun were 6F4 shut down today. The loss of pilots at the beginning of the war was just unbelievable. I have no idea how your dad survived, but again, he was a good pilot. I mean, he went up one day with a 4-ship, Texas 1, 2, 3, and 4, and he was the only one that came back. Yeah, just, it was nerve-wracking. And of course, we couldn't talk. There was no phone. We couldn't talk on the phone. The only way to communicate was to write a letter, and that could take 2 or 3 weeks to get there. It was weird and difficult. So anyway, but we made it. So the assignment was for a year. And I think when the government or the head of the military saw how many planes and pilots they were losing, and nobody wanted to fly up north. I mean, you had to, but so they changed the assignment from a year to, for every 25 sorties you flew into North Vietnam, you got a month knocked off. So your dad ended up coming back in, I think, 8 months. He got 100 sorties on that first assignment to Vietnam, and got to come back early. So he came back in July of 67, and we got stationed at Hamilton Air Force Base.
And that, so when he came back, you guys landed at Hamilton.
We did. Well, he came back to Mesa. We packed up my stuff. We came to the beach, and then we drove to San Francisco when we got our orders. Hamilton Air Force Base.
In the Oldsmobile 442?
Yes. No. Oh, golly. I had forgotten this horrible part. So Sambo and Kate came to Tampa. He had just finished his assignment, or his Rhodes Scholarship. And he had not gone through pilot training yet. So he was actually behind your dad at pilot training. So he was to start pilot training at Williams Air Force Base. In September, Todd was 18 months old, and Kate was 7 or 8 months pregnant, 8 months pregnant. And they were going to Williams Air Force Base, too. And guess what? they had bought an MGB, which they picked up in Tampa. It was shipped to Tampa, and they wanted to see us. And so I said to Sambo and Kate, there's no way you can drive to Weems Air Force Base with Todd being 18 months old. See, they didn't know she was going to get pregnant and when they ordered that car, and Kate being 7 or 8 months pregnant across that desert. I mean, there's nowhere for a baby to sit to start with, and she couldn't hold him. He was way beyond that. So guess what we did? We volunteered to let them use our 442, and we would drive their MGB across, right? Smart. So they took the 442, and we took the MGB, and holy cow, that was in in September. You know how hot it is across the desert in September. But anyway, we did it. We got there, and so they were living on the base. I guess they got base housing because they had one kid, one on the way, two on the way, whatever. And I think Sambo was a captain by then anyway, because he was older, you know. And so they got housing on the base. And that was the other reason I decided to stay in Mesa. I was like, well, Sambo and Kate are here.
Okay.
And I didn't know they were having twins at the time. I was like, I can help them, and it'll be nice to have them here, you know. So that's what that and mom and dad being in El Paso, I was like, this is where I need to be. And of course, mom and dad wanted me to come to El Paso, and I was like, no, you still got Richard and Ben at home, and I need to do my own deal. So
what rank was dad during this period?
He was a first and second lieutenant, or I should say second and first lieutenant.
What is the entry level rank in the Air Force?
Second lieutenant.
Okay.
Second lieutenant.
So second lieutenant, first lieutenant.
I think he got first lieutenant captain.
Okay.
I think he got promoted to captain shortly after he returned. Well, you know, he was a war hero then. Oh, there's a time period. You got a time thing that goes with those promotions too. But, you know, he had done 100 missions up north and gotten home.
Yeah.
And of course they wanted to send him again. Hello.
Yeah.
So you were only supposed to have to go back to war once every 3 years, but it got to be ridiculous because they didn't have enough pilots. They lost so many pilots. So Bill left, I think it was, like I said, the 12th of October. And I got settled in and got my job and started that and school and, you know, would visit Sambo and Kate most on the weekends usually. And the time went by. So anyway, he got back. We went to Tampa. No, we didn't go to Tampa. Where did we go? When he came back, we went to Sherman Air Force Base for a 3-month training, which is just north of Dallas. It's in Denton, Texas. Or Sherman, Texas. Texas.
Wait, so when he returned in July of 1967, before Hamilton, you went to Sherman.
Yeah, Sherman for 3 months of training. And then we went to Tyndall Air Force Base for 3 more months of training because he was going into the F-106, a different airplane, which was an Air Defense Command airplane.
AF-106?
Protecting the United States.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Just F-106. So we lived in Mexico Beach that winter for 3 months. It was freezing cold. We had no heater in our old beach house. And it was fun. We were right next to the canal there. We went fishing every day. We caught speckled trout. We went to the officers club at Tyndall almost every night and ate oysters. There was the most magnificent shucker at that Air Force Base I've ever seen. And yeah, it was fun. Steve and Vicky came down for a visit and fishing.
I was going to say, Steve Bright tells the story of quite a New Year's Eve at that place.
Yeah. I will not repeat anything else. and then we had your dad was a captain by then because we had a young lieutenant and his wife living. We lived in a little concrete block duplex, you know, like Aunt Mary's, but two people in it, one upstairs and one downstairs. We were in the upstairs one. And, he insisted on calling me ma'am, which, you know, I was 20 years old, right? Yes, ma'am. Yes, because Bill was higher rank than he was. I was like, would you stop? We didn't have a TV or anything in that place. We played pinochle with them several nights a week for entertainment. So yeah, that was fun. And then we got back in the car and headed for San Francisco. So after Tyndall, drove out there. That was a great adventure too.
You were back in your Oldsmobile 442 at that point, I hope.
Yep. Yep. So we picked it up in Phoenix. They were at Williams Air Force Base. Yeah. So when Bill came back from Vietnam that first time, we did those 3 months at Sherman, Texas, and 3 months at Tyndall Air Force Base in the panhandle of Florida, as we know. And then we headed west to San Francisco, and we got out there, and we had, they put us in base housing in Novato, which was across the highway from Hamilton Air Force Base. We were qualified for a bigger, nicer unit, but they didn't have any available. So we lived in Novato, I think, for like a year and a half, and then moved across the highway to actual housing on the base.
And that was what, spring of 1968 when you moved to Hamilton?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably a good stopping point, since your years in San Francisco would be our next stretch, and I don't want to cut that short by any means. Don't you think, or do you?
No, I got great San Francisco stories.